trouble.
Welcome to our June series of seminars. It's a great pleasure to have with us Derek Woodard Lehman, lecturer in theology and ethics at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. His series title is Polarization and the Unmaking of America. Today's topic is A House Divided Against Itself, Understanding Polarization. Derek, welcome.
Thanks, Sarah, and thanks to all of you for coming, whether you're here in the room or out there on the Zoom. Before we get started, Sarah asked me if we could just open in a brief word of prayer. So please pray with me. God, we thank you for this beautiful summer day, for the sunshine and the sounds of birds singing as we made our way here to this community. We ask that you open our minds to your wisdoms, our hearts to your love, and you fill our hands with your mercy. We thank you again for all these things and ask you to be with us and to work in us in these next minutes. Amen. As Sarah said, my name is Derek Woodard Lehman. I work at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary on the other side of the river in the East End, right on the border of Highland Park and East Liberty. If you've been to the zoo or the big Home Depot over on that side of town, you've probably driven past us, whether or not you knew it. We're right there on the avenue just across from Obama High School. I work mainly in the Office of Advancement. I do community engagement and event management work with our community partners, getting our staff and students off campus and getting people like you on campus to engage in collaborative endeavors. And I also teach courses in theology and ethics, and especially public theology, which is a weird way of just saying the ways in which our faith intersects with public life. As Sarah said, our topic for the next 3 weeks of this Westminster seminar is polarization and the unmaking of America. Our topic today is understanding polarization, a house divided. Now, before we get started, I just want to say a brief word about my role in these seminars. Sometimes when we meet each other in a church fellowship hall or at a cocktail party or in the stands at our children or grandchildren's sports events, we say, oh, what do you do? When I tell people I'm an ethicist, they often think I must be a moralizing know-it-all like this guy who tells everyone what they're doing wrong and how they should otherwise live. If they don't immediately flee to talk to someone else and we get further into the conversation and I tell them I'm a Christian ethicist, they assume I'm a self-righteous moralizing know-it-all who tells them they're going to hell unless they shape up and fly right, much like Dana Carvey's famous character, the church lady. Now, in truth, there are ethicists who are moralizing know-it-alls. And in fact, not here, of course, other places, there are Christians who are nagging scolds. But that's not how I approach Christian ethics, and that's not how I'm going to approach our time together in these seminars. As I see it, an ethicist is more like a referee. In this case, this is Pier Luigi Collini, one of the most famous referees known for his shaved head and his almost manically intense eyes. The referee minds the boundaries and makes sure that we follow the rules of the game. But when they're doing their job, referees are not active players in the game. They just help the players play the game. If you're not inclined to sports metaphors, you might think of ethics as something like a courtroom. An ethicist is something like an attorney, hopefully a good-natured one like Matlock, played here by the incomparable Andy Murphy. And an attorney presents evidence and elicits testimony, tries to get different things into the record and the conversation and so forth about how we should think about these matters. At the same time, an ethicist is sort of like a judge, hopefully a more serious judge than Judge Judy, though I expect that our time together will be entertaining as well as enlightening. But a judge makes sure the proceeding remains in good order, that the rules are followed, that we guard against false testimony and erroneous evidence, and that we moderate the proceedings. Even so, the verdict is yours. You all are something like the jury. You are meant to draw your own conclusions. So if you came for a sort of know-it-all how-to guide to approach these sorts of things, you might want to leave now because you'll likely be disappointed. My goal is rather to inform and inspire and give you some insight and some tools to engage our polarized society. Does that make sense? Any questions before we get going? That said, let me make it equally clear that along the way, even though we're not talking about politics or elections, issues will arise. We'll talk about them as they do. Current officials, future officials, candidates may pop into the conversation, and we're happy to engage those as well. But we're more talking about the bigger picture of polarization rather than specific issues or specific personalities. So with that in mind, let's get started. This week, our topic is A House Divided, Understanding Polarization. Now, you likely recognize that first phrase, a house divided. You're good church folks, so you know that that rings a bell somewhere in the Gospels, Jesus talking about a house divided. And you might also recall Abraham Lincoln's famous speech of that title. Long before he was president, when he was just a candidate for the Senate, he gave a famous speech called A House Divided, and he was invoking that saying of Jesus from the Gospels. And in that speech, Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do expect the House to cease to be divided. It will become one thing or the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become lawful in the states, old as well as new, north as well as south." So the division Lincoln has in mind is that antebellum division between pro-slavery and anti-slavery, particularly as things like westward expansion were taking place and new states and territories were being admitted, and the nation had to decide, would they be admitted as free states, free territories, or slave states and slave territories. Now, Lincoln's remark is in some ways as fitting to our times as it was to his time, because social scientists and political scientists tell us that the United States is as divided as it has ever been in its history since the antebellum Civil War era. Fortunately, we are not actively taking up arms against one another. States are not seceding from the Union, yet public opinion is similarly polarized. And so that's why I thought we might begin with Lincoln. Show of hands, how many of you remember this speech from Abraham Lincoln from a long ago history course or civics course in high school? So a lot of nods, a lot of hands. That's good. Now, is it surprising to you that statistically speaking, public opinion is similarly divided now as it was then? Seeing some somber shaking of the head, that sort of plays into your own ordinary experience about what you expected? Good. This is because the depth and breadth of our disagreements are becoming increasingly significant and increasingly salient. Whereas once upon a time, politics may have been a small sideshow in our public life, it's becoming more and more predominant. And we'll talk about that dynamic in itself as well. And because of that, we tend to regard those with whom we disagree not simply as opponents, but often as enemies. We don't think that they're misguided or mistaken. We think that they're not only ignorant, we tend to think them malignant. It's not just that they're making a mistake, they're doing something wrong, thinking what they do believing what they do, living as they do, voting as they do. And that makes it really hard for us to get along in our day-to-day lives. And sometimes it makes it really, really hard for us to get along in our day-to-day church life. Because if we can't see eye to eye on these other things, it's hard to see eye to eye on what our mission and witness in the church might be. Now, quick sidebar, a lot of the theological reflection and analysis will come in the second and the third week. So we're setting that a little bit to the side, just trying to get up and running today with some more descriptive work. That's not to say we can't engage in reflection, particularly as we take questions, but just the theological heavy lifting will come in the coming 2 weeks. Let's begin at the beginning. When I say the word politics, or when you see it in big bold letters here on the screen, what comes to mind? Not rhetorical. You can just call out and I'll repeat so people in the Zoom can hear what you've said. So if I say politics, you say government, the process of making laws,
process of winning elections,
campaigns, debates, advertisements, bumper stickers, t-shirts, and all that goes into that, lawn signs. I think we say that again. The pursuit of power. What else? Okay, relationships between beliefs and people. Democracy, good. I hope that's still a part of our politics. Sometimes some of us might wonder, but under siege, okay. Any other thoughts or reactions? Okay. Okay. So the analogy or metaphor of a rubber band, as you stretch it, one of two things happens. It either sort of snaps back to center, the extreme ends come closer together, or if it's maybe one of those old brittle ones that's been in the bottom of your junk drawer for a couple of years, it's not quite strong and elastic like it used to be. If you pull it too far, it breaks. And that's sort of what happened in the antebellum era leading up to the secession and the Civil War in the 1860s. The rubber band got so attenuated that it broke. Say that one more time. Okay, so at present, there might be undue influence, and I take it you have things in mind like special interests and lobbyists and the like, and possibly corruption, where money talks and the rest of us are sort of just watching as the rich and the powerful make decisions for us in their interests, not ours.
Obstruction to getting the right.
Okay, say more.
In other words, the relationships or the power dynamics are overcoming the research or the discussion.
Okay.
Motivation becomes one of the relationships rather than the right.
Okay, so politics sometimes leads us not towards facts and truths, but maybe in the pursuit of power or influence that overrides, you know, we don't care if we're right, we just want to win, maybe is one way to say it.
And online, we have Eileen mentioning that order, a sense of order is part of this process.
Good. Good. So politics can have a negative or positive connotation depending on what we have in mind and who we're talking with and what we're talking about. If we're leaning in the direction that we've talked about here just a moment ago about power, influence, you know, winning elections at all costs, then politics is kind of gross. It's a dirty business and the people who are involved with it are kind of shady. But if we think of it more as neighbors coming together to organize, bring order to their common life, we think of it more in a low flying sort of a level, then maybe it's not so gross. Maybe it's actually a good thing. And as the gentleman said, it comes from that Greek word polis, which just means city. It's the way we organize our common life.
And online, law and rules.
Good.
Kind of follows.
Yep. So you guys hit most of the words here in the word cloud slide: democracy, power, people, laws, government, voting, and so forth. And we also might think of different systems of governance. We mentioned democracy because that's ours, but we know there are monarchies. We just had a transfer of monarchical power in the United Kingdom. The UK is a constitutional monarchy, so they have this vestigial royal family who has a fair measure of power and influence, though largely rhetorical and symbolic. But then they have a democratic establishment, sort of like ours, with a prime minister rather than a president, and House of Commons, House of Lords rather than Senate and House of Representatives. We also might think of politics in terms of controversial hot button social issues, illustrated here by the cacophony and chaos of overlapping word clouds. In any given election cycle, one or more issue comes to the fore, sort of as the predominant one, the one that becomes the basis on which many of us make our final decision about which candidate or candidates to vote for. We might think of things like abortion and immigration, racism, COVID policy, that sort of faded away and hopefully stays faded away as we're not masking and you're not sitting every other pew. But for a while, that was not just a big public health issue, but a political issue, because it was an exercise of power. The federal government, the state government, the municipal government saying, look, you can't come here unless you put the thing on your face and, you know, mind the 6-foot dots in the queue at the CVS and some places, you know, vaccinations and all that sort of thing. We hope that we don't have to delve back into that political quagmire, because we hope we don't have to revert to those measures. But all those sort of issue-y things are also part of our political life. And when we get into this territory, this is where we start to encounter dynamics of polarization. And our job this week, next week, and the following week is sort of like this little chap on the screen to tug on some of these threads, to see where they lead us, and to see if we can maybe disentangle them from that gnarly knot inside our heads. In a word, we want to understand polarization. We can begin to get a handle on polarization by simply thinking of perhaps the most obvious implication of polar. We think about our globe, the North Pole and the South Pole, right? It has a geographical sense, and the North Pole and the South Pole are just about as far as you can get from each other on the planet. So the first sense of polar or polarization is simply opposites. Chocolate and vanilla, rain and sunshine, beach or mountains when you're arguing over where to go on holiday for the summer with your family. These things are opposites, but they're not in conflict with one another. Very few advocates of vanilla ice cream go to war with advocates of chocolate ice cream and vice versa. You may have a spat with your partner about whether you're going to the beach this summer or the mountains, but it's not really an antagonistic encounter, or at least I hope it's not. But for some issues, we move from just being opposites into dynamics of opposition. You know, you and I are in the queue at the Baskin Robbins. You get your vanilla, I get my chocolate. We're sweet. You know, you get what you like, I get what I like. But with things about which we have stronger convictions, things in which you getting what you want means I don't get what I want, we drift into that more testy sense of polarization. We're not just opposites anymore, we're opponents. We're in opposition. If we both have to order the same thing and you order vanilla and that means I get vanilla, well, that's a different proposition, right? So when we get into this dynamic of opposition, this is the kind of polarization that we're really talking about. And as you likely experience in your ordinary life, this kind of opposition can get pretty aggressive, as it has in the past 10 years, the past couple of presidential elections. Our politics, at least when we're talking about that national electoral level, often feel more like a shouting match than a conversation. People aren't so much trying to be heard, you know, please listen to me, understand my point of view, our point of view. They're trying to shout down their opponents and drown them out. And when everybody's shouting, it's hard to hear anything. And the loudest voice usually wins.
It's okay.
So when we talk about polarization in this sense, we're starting to talk about that rubber band stretch to extreme ends of the political and ideological spectrum. On average, more and more of us are tending more and more towards one side or the other. Fewer and fewer of us are somewhere in the middle, and very few of us sort of travel back and forth from one side to the other. By every measure, over the past 50 years or so, basically since the end of the civil rights era, we are getting further and further apart. And we are getting more adamant in whichever side we tend to stand on. So it's not just that we're opposite, we're starting to be opposition. So not only do we hold divergent and distant positions on this or that, we are increasingly intense and insistent about them. This means common ground is shrinking. It means the area and opportunity for compromise is all but vanishing. But divergence and insistence alone are not the whole story, and it's not even the most important. So let's build this from the ground up. Let's take an issue that's been in the news on and off. It's not too controversial, although there are strong opinions, and that's legalization of marijuana. There are a number of states that have done this and other municipalities. And what's interesting about this issue is there are proponents of legalization on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. So there are conservative proponents of legalization because they tend to be libertarian. They think the government has no business legislating morality. This is a personal decision. It's about individual responsibility. It's basically a don't tread on me position. Then there are folks on the left side of the spectrum who are interested in things like criminal justice reform, who believe that drug policy and particularly criminalization are racially biased, and therefore decriminalization and legalization is a way of moving the needle on those issues. So what's interesting about this particular issue is people from the left, people from the right, people who tend to think of themselves as Republican or Democrat can converge in advocating the same policy. And likewise, people who are opposed can converge in arguing against it for the same, for different reasons. And that means that hypothetically in this case, there is a way to be different and divergent without being antagonistic. So this issue is just one that we can lift up as a case study that shows that all is not lost. There are still possibilities and ways to find common ground that are nonpartisan or bipartisan, and that allow us to come together in ways that are less polarized than what we often experience. Does that sense of polarization make sense, being polarized about an issue, pro or con, for or against? Any questions, comments about issue polarization before we move on? Yeah, go ahead.
To talk to the people on the other extreme and reach a consensus. So there has to be some principles, some idea that they hold in common that would enable them to meet and then discuss their differences.
Yeah, so we need some place or some reason to come together. So in this example, it's a piece of legislation or a program of legislation. So you come from the left, I come from the right, I'm a libertarian, you're a reformer, but this particular issue, we both have our own reasons to move it. The trick is finding that reason to come together when there isn't an obvious shared interest, where you coming to me, me coming to you, and us coming together gets both of us something that we want. So you're right. It's tricky when there isn't that opportunity. And then what we need is what you said is a principle. Why should I do this if there's nothing in it for me? Right? Beyond self-interest, why should I care about these other people, what they're on about? Why should I bother engaging them, listening to them, working with them? Other questions or comments about issue polarization? Diverging on this policy or that, this law or the other? All right. Issue polarization, believe it or not, is not the biggest problem for us right now. Because as we've seen with this example, we can find our way to common ground on different issues, and it's not the end of the world. What gives us that greater sense of anxiety, that greater sense of animosity, that shouting match sense of polarization is what social scientists and political theorists call identity polarization. So it's not that we disagree about this thing out there, legalize, criminalize, hand it out like candy. It's we disagree about who you are and who I am and whether or not we can live together. And that identity access can be any one of a number of things, and we know what they are. Race and ethnicity, sex and gender, regional, local differences, marital and family status, religion, atheism, if you are in a religion, which one, denomination, class, occupation, education. All of these things are less about laws and policies out there than they are about who we are in here and whether or not we can find our way to each other. Now, as you might imagine, these have different salience for different people in different circumstances. One of the most salient features of polarization in our contemporary society here in the United States is religion. The gap between those who practice some kind of faith, predominantly Catholic and Jewish faith in the United States, but faith in general, and then those who don't. Those who imagine themselves as atheists, think of themselves as secular, or in the contemporary idiom of younger generations, they're spiritual but not religious. They're a nun. Not a flying nun, you know, bless me, mother, but like a N-O-N-E, as in I ain't got no religion, right? Though that's one of the biggest axes of polarization. And if you know whether a person falls on one side or the other, you can pretty much guess a number of other things about who they are and how they'll relate to neighbors and how they'll think about public issues. Another big part of that is if you are a religionist, say a Christian or a Jew, for example, denomination. Are you quote unquote mainline or evangelical? Are you Catholic or Protestant? If you're Jewish, are you Reform or Orthodox? So even inside a shared faith community, a shared religious experience, there's still divergence. Another big one is ethnicity and race. Who you are, where you come from. Are you a recently arrived immigrant family, or has your people been here since the Mayflower and so forth? Nationality as well. And although we tend to think of ethnicity and nationality as sort of overlapping, oftentimes they don't. Education is another big axis of polarization. Whether or not you've gone to college is a big predictor of whom you associate with, how you will tend to think about public life, and which sort of views that you will hold. Though we wouldn't sort of think about it this way, maybe intuitively, two PhDs, people like me who spend a lot of time in libraries, from West Texas and West Hollywood have more in common being educated that way than two people of different education from them, say, those same locales. So education is a big sorter. It arranges us in different kinds of relationships. So too region. You know, you hear about Heartland America, the Bible Belt, the South, coastal, you know, cities, and so forth. Now, as you imagine, and as we can easily say, these different axes of identity can configure themselves in a variety of ways. As we've already talked about just for a moment, the primary axis of identity in our country right now is between religionists and nuns. That's one of the big predictors. Another one that's prominent more recently is dynamics of gender, sexual orientation, family structure, and so forth. And then also region. You know, are you from the city? Are you from a rural area? Are you from suburban, ex-urban areas? And what social scientists and political scientists tell us about these is that once upon a time, these different identities, these different circles that I'm illustrating here on the slide as bubbles, sort of moved about independently of each other. Since the end of the Second World War, they've started to not be as independent. There's a phenomenon that if you've, you know, listened to podcasts, read magazines, watch certain TV programs, there's a phenomenon that's called stacking. But rather than being independent variables, these things have started to align so they become concentric circles. So if you're urban, you're educated, you're middle or upper class, all those things now stack together. And so rather than having diverse sort of promiscuous identities where I'm a little bit country, I'm a little bit rock and roll, we're sort of all more becoming more monolithic. And our social circles become more monolithic, where we don't have everyday ordinary experience with folks who are different from us in these different ways. And when your identities become sort of stacked in this fashion, where I probably should have made the slide this way, where the circles aren't sort of a cool lava lamp tie-dye blob, but more of a, you know, cylinder, anyone outside the cylinder becomes in a certain way invisible and irrelevant. Not because we're big jerks, not because we hate people, but just because our ordinary everyday life doesn't take us into those other spaces. We don't simply know our neighbors in those sorts of ways. Yeah.
Yeah, that would seem to me to be an influence that creates perception.
Mm-hmm. That would seem to me to be an influence that creates perceptions of identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that the very religious person from the farmland, just to keep it real simple, achieves some kind of an identity without anything they did, but it's the others who are perceiving that identity. Sure. And attributing more values even to that identity and to that person than perhaps really are.
Good. Yeah, there are strong dynamics of perception and attribution. You know, I see you drive up in a Prius, I think one thing. I see you drive up in a pickup truck, I think something else. If I see the Whole Foods shopping bag, I think one thing. If I see the Giant shopping bag, I think another. And again, we don't twist our evil mustaches and think ill of each other. We're just habituated to read social cues. And it happens mostly, as philosophers will say sometimes, behind our back. Like, it's not a conscious cognitive process where we're, you know, going Prius guy, Democrat, liberal, you know, pickup truck guy, Republican, conservative. It just sort of all is kind of the operating system of our social software in the background. And until something brings it to the foreground, we don't tend to think about it a whole lot. So yeah, go ahead. Wait for the mic. That's good. We're
Where does the haves and the have-nots, the one percenters and the non-one percenters, are they, to me, when you watch the news, it's in a lot of the legislation, it's all geared towards that. Where does that fit into this?
Yeah, so that would be the green column at the right. So class position, 1%, 99 is the sort of hyper class distinction. That has to do also with occupation. So people who are mental laborers versus manual laborers, you know, do you move data around spreadsheets and websites, or do you move lumber around construction sites? And that's also tied to education. Now, what's interesting about the particular class distinction that you mentioned is the 99% bucket is a very diverse bucket, if for no other reason than it's 99% of us, right? So if and when we step out of these other configurations of identity into that one, well, we find ourselves in very mixed company because most of us are the 99%, as the math tells you.
It's also interesting that that green column doesn't explicitly name economic status.
Sure.
Class is not necessarily economic all the way down.
Right. Yeah. Class has more than economic significance, but all those three green things sort of track in the economic column. Now, with this phenomenon of stacking, with what used to be sort of more free-floating independent variables becoming consolidated, is that each of these becomes incredibly predictive. So social scientists with survey instruments and algorithms can, you know, this is the same reason Amazon tells you what you want before you know what you want, is that if they know one or two of these variables, they can predict almost all the others because they're incredibly correlated. And one reason is we no longer have, in recent generations, experiences like the two world wars or the Depression, where everybody was sort of involved in this thing that mixed us together. You know, with conscription in World War II, you had people from all over the country, just about every class, every race, every ethnicity, everything thrown into units shoulder to shoulder. So we haven't had one of those sort of comprehensive mixings of all our people.
COVID's
interesting because it was a common experience, but what was the single most dominant experience of COVID, do you reckon? Vaccinated or not, but we were isolated. We were all in it together, but we were in our houses. I've got a tiny little house in O'Hara Township with two kids and a dog, and I was trying to do my work. My wife was trying to do her work. And in between, we're trying to get two kids through two different online learning. So COVID was a coming together experience in a certain sense, the ways that other sort of generational events in the past were. But it's sort of a weird one because we experienced it together apart. We were socially distant. We were home learning. We were remote working, right?
I might have missed something, but sure. You might have already said this, but it seems like we're more diverse. There's more diversity than there's ever been, mm-hmm. But that may be a product of the media making all this visible. So my question would be, what is it that would make us tolerant of such extreme diversities? So that we wouldn't be so,
yep.
Just, you know, separated.
Yeah, lots of thoughts. A couple of those I'm going to beg you to come back next week. So next week is where we're going to start getting into response and reaction and eventually Christian witness amidst all this. So I don't want to talk about the media as in the big bad boogeyman that manipulates, you know, fake news, you know, alternative facts, and everybody think. But so set aside that sense of the media. I will be 47 in October, so I'm older, but not too terribly old. But I remember not having a television. I remember not having cable television. So in a different, not in the scary like the media sense, but in a different media ecosystem, our worlds were a lot smaller. Yeah, I knew about California, but I'd never been, and until I went to college, I'd never met anybody from California. I grew up in upstate New York, small town in the Dairy Belt above the Finger Lakes, right? So part of our experience and perception of diversity, of difference, is just the awareness we have. Like, we know everything, or if we choose to, we know everything about school kids in Bangladesh. Because there's a blog, there's a website, there's a Twitter feed, there's an Instagram, there's a TikTok. So our world is exponentially bigger and has exponentially more inputs, which can be a good thing because, wow, there's cool, weird people that do different stuff. That's fantastic. I want to try that food. I want to listen to that music. I want to read that novel. I want to see that film. But it also can be threatening. It can be scary. So part of it is how we encounter that. And we'll talk a little bit next week about that. I think a lot of us don't do a great job of sort of absorbing and processing all that. And that's in part because that takes work, right? It's a lot to manage. It was a lot easier when my circle of concern ended at the county line and my awareness was whatever my small town little newspaper that landed on the front porch every morning told me. Now I know about everything, and in some sense I feel engaged and obliged by everything. Like, shoot, what am I going to do about, you know, the Rohingya in Burma, Myanmar, right? Yeah, question from the Zoom.
And in line with that, I would argue that though COVID was an experience that we all had, because of so much information that flooded us, it actually was not a common experience. People experienced it in very different ways. You know, some of us were not even isolated, but sure, instead working as the clerk at the grocery store, experiencing the fear of coming into contact with people who were going to give you something that killed you. And other people had a different experience about the hoax of COVID, and other people had the experience of, wow, this is this educated me about the freedom of remote work. Yay.
Good. Yeah. So alongside, and this is what we'll talk about quite a lot next week, alongside this phenomenon of identity stacking, comes information sorting, right? You know, on one hand, we have access to all the information. www.google.com, you can find anything you want and a whole bunch of stuff you don't want. But because the way that those media, and then here we're invoking now the more the media works, Google tends to know who you are. It sees your stacked identity based on your searches and your websites and your bookmarks, and it sends you down the same paths. So we live in this paradoxical experience of having access to more and more information and experience, but being served up smaller and smaller slices of it. And we'll talk about that next week. That's a big part of our topic next week. So the significance and salience of all these things, as I said a moment ago, is consistent across all kinds of social science studies, where if we know one or two of these characteristics, we can, you know, predict most of the others. And that's because they're not separate phenomena. They're now interrelated and stacked parts of a single identity, which has been aggregated into politics. I added a new bubble on this slide. Party, political party. My granddad was a county commissioner. He is a Republican. His best buddy playing golf was the Democrat that was the deputy commissioner. And they had more in common being small town, upstate New York guys who played golf at the public course and had fought in World War II together, not literally together, but, you know, as a generation. Whereas now, those kinds of, even at the local level, relationships are more fraught. Once upon a time, parents and grandparents couldn't imagine their children or grandchildren marrying someone of a different religion, a Catholic or a Protestant, a Jew and a Christian. Now what we can't imagine is marrying someone whose ideological beliefs are in the other party. Over 45% of Americans say they would find it troubling if their children married someone who was a registered member of the other party. Hugely salient. All these differences have become stacked inside this cylinder of partisan identity. They kind of have all added up to that. And when we get that way, that's where we get into these shouting matches. And so these identities have stacked into two partisan identities. So the DNC with their donkey tends to be urban, interracial, secular, digital labor rather than manual, more immigrant, more coastal, lots of advanced degrees, and often non-traditional family structures. Conversely, the Republican, the GOP elephant, faith, monoracial, white, traditional families, rural and ex-urban, less college educated, material labor, native born, and more in the heartland of America. Well, that would be lovely. So I lived in New Zealand for 3 years with my family before we moved back here to Pittsburgh. And there are 12 parties in New Zealand, five of which generally have significant representation in the parliament. So there are two major parties, Labour and National, which are roughly Democrat and Republicans, center right, center left, although more to the left of where American politics are because it's, you know, it's a social welfare state with nationalized healthcare and so forth. So they do have a two-party dynamic, but because it's a parliament, not a Senate, to form a government, they always need to include minority parties. And so there's these other parties that then get seats in the parliament and also seats on the cabinet because you're National, you're Labor, you guys don't have a simple majority. You know, so you come to the Maori party, the native party, or you come to New Zealand first and you say, let's make a government. And I say, great, what do I get? You know, like, sweet, I'm the finance minister. My lieutenant is the, you know, minister of foreign affairs and trade. So there's a lot more structural incentive to compromise in a multi-party system.
Sometimes in trying to find out how a problem developed, there's this principle of follow the money. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see that on your chart, economics, but maybe it seems to fit in to a great extent. Follow the money, and that explains why certain things happen.
Yeah, I think two things about that. At the level of national campaigns and federal government, I think that's very much the case. We have a two-party system, but they're both parties of big money. It's just different big money. In the terms of our local everyday experience walking around in the world, I don't know as the money part of it is as influential, other than, as we'll talk about next week, there are huge financial incentives for media companies, entertainment companies, and people who make just about anything to keep us agitated. So if you remember, we're kind of getting the cart ahead of the horse here, but if you remember the old media adage, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, the new media adage is if it screams, it streams. Because our negative emotion keeps us clicking through to the next tweet, to the next Instagram post, to the next TikTok video, to the next blog. Yeah. So if I'm trying to make money on a web-based platform of any kind, I make more money if I make you more mad. If I make you think, those sons of bitches, they're at it again with their bullshit, part of my French in church. Oh, no, it's not even close. It's like exponentially, you know, more engagement with negative emotion. But we'll get to that next time. So as I said before, we have fewer and fewer of us have experiences of mixed company. This is sort of a silly graphic I got from a think tank website. You know, so most of the elephants, so to speak, go to one side. Most of the Democrats go to the other. You know, you'll notice at the bottom left, there's a random, let's see, let me look at it. So yeah, bottom left, there's a random elephant hanging out with the donkeys. On the bottom right, there's a couple of donkeys hanging out with the elephants. And there's a few people kind of saying what's up in the middle. But more and more, we don't have those kinds of what social scientists call cross-cutting relationships and experiences. And we'll talk about how we can cultivate those kinds of relationships experiences a little bit next week. And so we sort ourselves into these kind of mega identities that are roughly aligned with the two parties, but also, as we said a moment ago, have these sort of cultural tells. It's Cracker Barrel and Whole Foods. Not Cracker Barrel anymore. Apparently they've gone around the bend with their support for Pride Month, and all these people are now posting about how awful Cracker Barrel is. So as of 5 minutes ago, my slide is out of date and I didn't have a chance to update it. It's Dunkin' and Starbucks. It's Prius and pickups. It's Wine Moms and NASCAR Dads. We have all these readily identified, you know, sort of cultural tropes that sort of instantiate and symbolize and capture these stacked identities. And because they're stacked and because they're identities rather than issues, as we said before, they feel more close to home, more personal, more like not disagreeing me about an opinion, but more like saying, my mom is so ugly that. And when we deal with each other, in this register of identity, it's harder and harder to de-escalate and engage sanely and sensitively. You all no doubt are more sanctified and pious than I am, but imagine, if you will, a disagreement with your spouse or your partner. When the disagreement goes to "you always," or "you never," or "you are," it's a lot harder to make any kind of progress other than to just be like, I'm leaving, I gotta go take a walk. Whereas if we're talking about, hey, like, remember when you said you were gonna go to the grocery store and get the groceries and now you didn't and it's dinner and we don't have any food? That's a much easier conversation than, I can never rely on you to do anything. Right? Because you're like, wow, I just got slugged in the face with a baseball bat versus scolded because I forgot to do something I said I would do. On analogy, our politics are a lot more like that screaming, shaming you so-and-so. And so what we're going to talk about starting next week and into the third week is how to move our heads and our hearts out of that you so-and-so always never register, this, you know, crazy screaming cartoon, into a more de-escalated sense of, okay, you're different, I'm different, let's try to engage that in a more sane and less high stakes fashion. Because if we don't, we're going to, I wish I had the rubber band slide now to end with, but we're going to be like that old rubber band that's been in the junk drawer too long. And it's going to come farther and farther. And at some point, somehow, some way, it's going to snap.
One of the grounds for divorce is irreconcilable differences.
Yeah.
So do we have irreconcilable differences?
Well, I don't think we do. I think that question is being asked more and more by more and more ordinary citizens. And as we said before, it's a good way to get a job in Washington or Harrisburg if you can tell that kind of story. Those people over there, they're coming for your jobs, your kids, your truck, your retirement, your guns, whatever it is. I mean, we can proliferate the boogeyman. Those folks are coming for your whatever. It goes equally well both ways.
An 8-year-old who's now in her early 40s said to us in Sunday school once, when you start a sentence with "you," then trouble is ahead. Just because it's like putting a finger in somebody's face. Mm-hmm. "You" said, "you think, you are." It's just that "you" versus, well, what I feel about this is this.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's easier for a politician to get elected by telling you how crappy the other candidate party position is than by sanely and sensibly saying, here's why this program or policy or law is better than that one. Because it's boring to hear that message. It takes a lot more seconds, a lot more words to explain something like that. Whereas if you can, you know, what's your name, sir? Daniel? What's your last name?
Dan Paul. What is he up to now? He says he's for the people, but his parents run a...
Like, that ad is way easier to make and makes me go, oh, Dan Paul did what? Whereas if you're like, it would be really great if we had a regional tax base for public schools rather than a local tax base, because that would share... You know, like, so the register in which we conduct our national debates and even our regional, like, it's just, it's rock'em sock'em robots. Like, it's MMA. It's, and the same thing, you know, like we said earlier, and like we'll talk about it some length next week, we click through to that next post more when we're mad than we do. I mean, granted, we all love cat videos and cute animal pictures on the internet. I have a 12-year-old that we look at these every night before bed, you know, like, oh, look, it's a duck and a dog. They're friends. Isn't that sweet? So it's weird. The internet has, you know, animal friendships, and then it's like all this other horrible muckraking stuff. We've got a couple minutes before we leave out. Any last questions, comments, snide remarks before we break till next time?
What happened, what developed for us to realize or recognize such diversity? Because I don't think people have changed. I mean, I know there's more immigration and there's the internet that brings more messages to us. But what's behind all this?
That's an easy question. Three things, I think. Let's see if I can hit all three. I think some of it is sheer exposure. I think as our worlds became bigger and bigger due to mass-mediated technologies, we just simply encountered more different stuff, different people. I mean, think about, can anyone else besides me remember the first time they sat down at a table and were given chopsticks, not silverware? I can. In third grade, a new anesthesiologist moved to town to work at the hospital, and his son, Wending, was in my class, and we were friends. And one thing, you know, as, you know, elementary school kids do, I was over at Wend's house, and we sat down to dinner, and there were two twigs on the napkin. I mean, I was in third grade. Just something as simple as that, like the simple encounter of, oh, like, people eat with things other than a knife and a fork? That's kind of wild. Like, how'd that happen? So I think some of it is exposure and experience. I think some of it is the way in which political and commercial entities leverage difference as a, you know, a wedge issue. And then the third thing is, and this is a little trickier and would be the subject of a whole nother Westminster seminar series, is there are weird things that we're learning more and more about our brains and our bodies in cognitive neuroscience and evolutionary biology, where our primitive hard wiring for group identity when we were trying to not be killed by saber-toothed tigers is still inside us, and it's part of that is what gets activated by the algorithm that feeds you anger. It's that very vestigial fight, flight thing that is hardwired in.
I would add a fourth thing, and that is that over the last half century or so, the order of things has changed in ways that is a huge disruption. Because I lived through integration of schools in the South, and we rode the bus to a school that was in a part of town that was referred to with a racial epithet. That reality that was just the order of things in the 1970s is not a reality that is acceptable today. And yet, you know, that's very disorienting to people who have lived through that change in reality. You know, it's just, you know, that order of things is threatening, just like, you know, the threat to the order of things when the KKK rose up, you know, caused the KKK to rise up.
Yeah, I think it's one thing for there to be difference in different people. It's a different thing when that difference then starts to make claims on me and how my part of the world operates.
And this isn't new. Our Friday Men's Group has just finished a book about the time around World War I.
Okay.
And how divisive it was. I mean, incredibly. Every bit as divisive as now. So it's not new. We just have the internet to accelerate it.
Yeah. Okay. Last one, because I know you guys got to get out to go to lunch and I got to get home and get my kid to a soccer game.
Another thing to expand on your comments about the internet, it's not just that it brings ideas to us that we wouldn't receive normally, but it allows us to create isolated communities that include people all over the world, where within these communities, you know, they have their ideology and they refuse to allow any opinions that go against the party doctrine, so to speak.
Yep. Come back next week for social media and social conflict. That's where we're going next. Until then, thank you for your time, attention, and especially for your contributions. And we'll see you then. It's Keynote, so it's the Apple version.